store.
Wherever you are, Truth Frequency Radio.
Hello. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys very much for tuning in. Holy cow. Chat room is filling up and we have the one and only Kev Baker in here this morning. He must have known that I was going to dish out some accolades for his show on Friday night. Amazing stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Just absolutely love this network. Cannot talk highly enough about Kev Baker's show. If you missed it on Friday, definitely go back and check that out. They were talking about CERN, and I think I kind of got the chat room distracted by bringing up CERN, but it was just such a great show. Kevin, we got to get you an extra hour, brother. We got to get you an extra hour. I don't know when you find time to sleep, but seriously, man, just really good stuff and really would like to have you on for another hour. Pretty much can say that about all the hosts here at TFR. Just an amazing, amazing environment. I hate to come on here every single day and just kind of like, you know, talk about how great it is because I'm sure it gets old, but man, it's so fantastic to be here. And I don't think if you guys are not out there doing a radio show every day, you don't know how much work it takes to get on the air every single day and to make something, you know, cohesion happen in your brain and, you know, do this stuff every day. And the guys that do, like Kevin does the show all the time. It's just, it's crazy how much effort it takes. And, on a lot of other networks, there's a lot of political nonsense, the non-sharing of guests, the backstabbery and things like that. It's just not how it is here at TFR. It's absolutely not the way it is. And, people who keep coming over like Roger Sales Show, who's, gonna be after my show today and going all the time from here on out, found that same thing to be true, just as absolutely as tickled as a pig in mud to be part of this team, and as am I. And just, man, it was a great weekend. If you guys got to listen over the weekend, the Friday Night Woo Crew was awesome. Just super good stuff. If you guys are like me and stay home all the time, TFR is not a bad place to spend your time, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, it's Monday. I hope you guys are doing well. The weather here in Missouri was and still continues to be absolutely stunning. Got the house opened up. It's so nice to finally be in springtime mode. I hope you guys had a wonderful weekend. I know it's Monday, the first day of the crisis hostage situation. I understand the hostage crisis. But we're going to get through it together like we always do. Anyway, today is the 23rd day of March. As I said, it's Monday. We're live right now. And if you guys, like all of our other good friends in the chat room right now, want to hang out in the chat room, please do go to TFR, truthfrequencyradio.com. Check out the chat room. Lots of good listeners, having great conversations. I really appreciate the people who show up every single day. And I mean, where else can you go and, get a chance to talk to the one and only Kev Baker live at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Monday? I mean, golly, what a great deal this is. Anyway, getting into the Monday news, the agenda to control the world and drive us into submission, still raging on, ladies and gentlemen, both economically and geopolitically around the world. So, you know, that's part of what we do here at the Red Pill Reports, is try and figure out exactly what's going on, who's driving this agenda, and where we're going next. And in that vein, I'm very excited to be bringing you guys an amazing guest today. We're going to kick off the week here pretty on a big high note. But Daniel Estulin is going to be joining us all the way from Spain here in about an hour. He is the author of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, which is pretty much the foremost authority on the Bilderberg Group. If you want a book about the Bilderberg Group or have no idea what I'm talking about, this is going to be a show you don't want to miss. Some people might ask if the Bilderberg Group is even relevant anymore, but I would argue that it probably is, and I believe Daniel will also. Also, in the news. I believe it's been disclosed as of this weekend when the next meeting is going to be taking place for the Bilderberg crew. But I will save that until Daniel shows up in about an hour, as I said, to disclose some of that information with you guys. Let's also do a little conjecture about which way we're going to go and what's going to go on. Now, he's in Spain, which is obviously one of the countries that's very, very affected by the ECB, this new quantitative easing, and it's going to be interesting to get his perspective. So I'm very, very excited to be bringing Daniel Estulin to the program today so that all of you guys can have an opportunity to talk to him, listen to him. If you have questions, getting into the chat room now is a good idea. Then you can steward those questions across, and I will pose them to Daniel when he comes on. Sharon Wyeth is going to be joining us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about – oh, sweet. Just as a side note, Daniel Estulin will be hopefully on the Kevin Baker Show this week. Is that this week, Kevin, I hope? See, this is why I like the chat room, because we get to disclose all this awesome stuff and you guys can find out about other shows during our show, and then they can talk about our show during their show. It's just like one big love fest here at TFR. Absolutely love it. So anyway, I like it when Kevin tells me what's going on with his shows later, because then I can plug it. And it's important. I like starting off TFR on a high note, because then I feel like there's no reason for you guys to turn it off for the rest of the day. You just start off big bang right off the gate, get your brain stems working, and then you just go on, you know, you just go on from there. And it just gets better and better as the day goes on. You just learn all kinds of amazing stuff. Rebecca Roth on Wednesday. Oh man, I'll tell you what, Rebecca Roth is making the rounds. I saw a picture of her. She made the mistake, ladies and gentlemen, of coming on many, many, many programs in the last week. And by many, I mean hours. I believe she was on the Power Hour. She was also on Coast to Coast over the weekend. I think she did Susan Lindauer's show. Lots and lots and lots. And I'll tell you, this is a rookie mistake. A lot of these rookie authors make this mistake. They go on these huge shows and then they volunteer to autograph the books when you buy one. And I saw a picture of Rebecca Roth literally surrounded by books over the weekend. I can imagine that the carpal tunnel is starting to set in, because so many people have wanted to get the Methodical Illusion book since she has been on all these programs. And I got to tell you, it's fantastic. The information inside the book is amazing, and the way she discloses it is amazing. I will be absolutely tuning in to the Kev Baker Show, because not only did Rebecca Roth do an amazing amount of research, but she's actually still doing the research as we speak. She was disclosing to me off of air after our interview some of the things that she was still stumbling across in this terabyte of FOIA requested FAA information that she has at her disposal. And I'll tell you what, by the time she gets on Kevin Baker's show on Wednesday, who knows what she will have figured out. So you're not going to want to miss that, and you're not going to want to miss, I mean, I gotta say, she's been on a lot of shows, but she has not been interviewed by the one and only Kev Baker yet. So I'm imagining that we're gonna get to a whole new depth in the in Rebecca's information on that show. So when I get more information on when that is, oh, it's Wednesday, so I don't need more information. So Wednesday, tune in to Kev Baker's show in the afternoon. Wednesday here, you'll want to be here anyway, because Clint Richardson is going to be joining us that morning. He was on a couple of weeks ago. He's got the website Corporation Nation, I believe is his website. Amazing, amazing stuff. Kind of in the same vein as Roger Sales, very much interested in the sovereign movement, understanding where it is that we actually are in the world in terms of legality versus lawfulness. And so you can tune in Wednesday morning to Clint Richardson's show, and then just stay tuned all day, Rebecca Roth on Kev Baker's show. And then Deborah Tavares is going to be joining us on Thursday. Oh man, tell you what, probably one of the, one of the foremost authorities on Agenda 21 and some of the agencies, the ancillary agencies, alphabet type agencies, and their encroaching legislation as they're, trying to continually push us down, with a big boot on the face, apparently is what's going on right now. I'm getting to the news just one second. I know I'm rambling a lot. L.A. Marzulli on Friday, ladies and gentlemen. So again, absolutely amazing lineup for the week. Guys behind the scene, Robert and Fletch, doing just an amazing job with the website and with scheduling. And without those guys, we couldn't possibly be here at all. And without you guys out there listening, supporting the show, sharing it with your friends, we wouldn't be doing anything at all. We'd be doing nothing whatsoever. So appreciate you guys being here more than you could possibly even imagine, and that goes about triple for you there, Kev. Okay, getting into the news right now. As I mentioned again, the agenda to control the world still rampantly running around, succeeding apparently, and our desire to have an unstable Middle East hit a new high point over the weekend. We've been talking about Yemen and the collapse of said country over the last couple of weeks. But now Shiite rebels have seized Yemen's third largest city, which is Taiz, according to officials, after the U.S. announced the evacuation of remaining special forces that were involved in a drone campaign against al-Qaeda there. So the Yemeni president is appealing now to the U.N. for help. So amid this escalating violence that threatens to engulf the country, Washington announced that it would evacuate its remaining personnel from the country, including about 100 special operation forces that have been waging unmanned drone strikes against al-Qaeda militants in the region. Reuters, citing national security sources, said that the last major U.S. military contingent had been stationed at the Al Anad airbase in southern Yemen, while the unmanned drones fly out of a U.S. military base bordering Saudi Arabia. State Department spokesperson Jeff Rathke said all remaining U.S. staff have been temporarily relocated and emphasized that Washington would continue to actively monitor terrorist threats emanating from Yemen and take action to disrupt continuing imminent threats to the United States. So there you go. The U.S. pullout comes as Yemen officials said that rebels from the Ansar Allah movement have seized the country's third largest city, Taiz, in the south of Yemen. And residents said the rebels seized the city's military airport and military base from local authorities on late Saturday afternoon. At the same time, Houthi rebels, who now controlled Sana'a, which is the country's capital, announced general mobilization. The U.S. embassy last month closed its operations in Sana'a after the Houthis took command of the capital, leading to a situation where two rival governments in the north and south are competing now for power. The Houthis say they are fighting in order to stop the spread of Salafism, the adherents of which command a strict observance of Islamic teaching. Speaking from the port city of Aden, Yemeni President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi had called upon the Houthi Shiite rebels to relinquish Sana'a, which was taken last year, together with weapons and supplies taken from the army. Of course, this follows up on the story last week of the half a billion, that's billion with a B as in boy, that is a lot of money, half a billion dollars of weapons that we just happened to abandon in Yemen. For now, I'm sure that, you know, being divvied up amongst these two factions that now control Yemen. So, port city. Right there, a port country, really very important there for the oil transference past the Strait of Hormuz. Not good stuff that we've lost control of Yemen. But is it par for the course? Is it what they actually want to be going on there right now? I don't know. I mean, really, it seems like a clandestine transfer of a whole lot of military weapons to a bunch of people that we probably, you know, you and I probably don't want to have them. But there you go. Speaking of people we don't want to be doing anything, really. The Islamic State posted a warning online in what it says are, and also what it says are the names, the United States addresses, and the photos of 100 American military service members and called upon its brothers residing in America to kill them. So there you go. The Pentagon said all this after the information was posted on the internet and that it was investigating the matter. The U.S. defense officials, speaking, of course, under condition of anonymity, said that they cannot confirm the validity of the information, but they are looking into it. So long story short, ISIS came out over the weekend. They posted ostensibly what they said they got from hacked military databases, servers, and emails. Essentially, the information of 100 members of the U.S. military, you know, what they look like, where they live, what their ranks are, all the information that they could muster, apparently, and hopes that a lone wolf attacker would go out and commit jihad against them. So I'm not really sure that that's necessarily a real threat, but they do want to keep this threat of ISIS alive. And the New York Times says it looks like most of this information had not come from any kind of hacked U.S. government server or anything like that, but instead that they were just cultivated from public records, residential addresses, things like that. Can you say Facebook, ladies and gentlemen? So, again, the United States has made a plea to its military people out there to try and keep all of your military affiliations off of Facebook, social media, things like that. Don't put any pictures of yourself up in military uniforms. There were a lot of warnings about Europe kind of through that Christmas period through the UK and also Europe about military people from really any of the coalition states going through airports and things like that dressed in your military uniforms. Just not necessarily a great idea right now. So just bearing that in mind, that's the only reason I'm putting it out. Again, this is a Yahoo News article, so probably has more to do with keeping the fear alive. But again, Just something you guys should know. Also, there was an assault on Jewish worshipers in London over the weekend. A group of approximately 20 youths attacked a local synagogue in the London suburb of Stamford Hill over the weekend, yelling threats, beating worshipers, and vandalizing property. Again, though, this news comes from Israel Hezdollah, which is a media news organization there in Israel. So just putting that into perspective, I just want to make sure we all understand where the news is coming from, not just that it is, in fact, news. But again, this incident did, in fact, happen. One witness belonging to the Ahavat Torah congregation, which is the name of the congregation that was apparently attacked, described the mob as shouting, "We will kill you," as they proceeded to physically assault worshipers inside the synagogue and tear apart prayer books. Another Jewish local boy who had passed the scene rushed inside, grabbed one of the suspects with the intention of bringing him to the police, but he was quickly overwhelmed by the other attackers and suffered strikes to the face, and he lost a tooth. That's no good. Police confirmed that they were treating the attack as an anti-Semitic incident, and police were called to the scene early Sunday morning, just after 1 a.m. local time, when a group of intoxicated men believed to have come from a nearby party tried to gain entry into the synagogue. So again, six people fairly drunk attacking a synagogue in North London, and they are calling it an anti-Semitic attack. So that's what's going on there. I don't know. I agree. Any country is suspect, Kev. Bunch of crazy people out there. Okay. I don't know if I want to cover this too much here. But we've been talking quite a bit about Iran. Iran, I really go back and forth on, because it's important to understand that Iran, much like us, has got different political factions that actually work inside the country. So it's easy for us, you know, it'd be easy for a country outside of the United States to just look at the United States, pick on some idiot like John McCain and say, okay, everybody in their government is a warmongering, you know, whack job. And they'd be right, you know, for the most part, if you were to actually break it down into statistics. But it would still be unfair to, you know, to say Americans are evil based on the actions of John McCain, okay, or Bush or Cheney or Rummy or any of the other people that I ran out of fingers here. But okay, and now Khamenei. Khamenei is the, what do you want to call it? He's not the president of Iran. He's the supreme leader. I think that means he is like the supreme religious leader. Okay. So anyway, he was doing a speech on Saturday, which was the day after President Barack Obama appealed to Iran to seize a quote unquote historic opportunity for this nuclear deal and a better future. And the U.S. Secretary of State also claimed on Saturday substantial progress towards this accord. So Khamenei is standing in Tehran. He's talking to a crowd there in Iran. And he essentially is telling the crowd that he is not going to capitulate to Western demands, given, again, that he is not the president and really doesn't have a lot of say, other than he is kind of the spiritual guide for the Iranian people right now. So the crowd there, in listening to him kind of start, you know, his little rhetoric here, starts shouting, "Death to America, death to America, death to America." Okay, and so the Ayatollah eventually responds, "Yes, yes, yes, of course, death to America," because America is the original source of this pressure. So the news article that I'm reading right now is the Times of Israel. So again, coming from an Israeli news source, and the article headline is Khamenei calls for death to America. So that's, you know, you can obviously see at which point in the speech they pick on and want to sensationalize. But let's talk a little bit more about the rest of his speech, because he is talking about the United States, and he says they, being the United States, insist on putting pressure on our dear people's economy. He said, referring to economic sanctions aimed at halting Iran's nuclear program. What is their goal, he asks? What is their goal is to put the people against the system. He says the politics of America is to create insecurity, he added, referring both to U.S. pressure on Iran and elsewhere in the region. So Khamenei's comments contrasted with those of the Iranian president, Rouhani, who said that achieving a deal is possible by the March 31st target date for a preliminary accord. Kerry was also, well, he was a little more circumspect, as he spoke to reporters 6 days after negotiations in the Swiss city of Lausanne. The talks made substantial progress, he said, but important gaps remain. So just kind of putting that back out there, that while these very important negotiations are going on, the Times of Israel choosing to focus on the response from Khamenei to the crowd that he was speaking to and, you know, sensationalizing it, saying essentially that Iran really wants death to America, which I don't necessarily believe. I think Iran wants their currency back, and I think Iran probably wants to get on with their lives without the constant pressure of the United States and also Israel. So anyway, huge marches over the weekend. Wow, we got a lot to talk about here. Thousands of people protesting in Dublin against these proposed water charges over the weekend. Tens of thousands, if not 100,000s. Organizers of the rally were this group called Right to Water. They said at least 80,000 attended the protest, and this was the fourth and largest mass protest since October when the Irish government, which is seeking re-election next year, decided to start charging the public for the water that they use. Irish politician Ruth Copinger urged the protesters not to give in and to go ahead and pay the water charges. Now, okay, I don't even know where to go from here to begin with. First of all, I'm kind of now beginning to be of the opinion that water should be a universal human right. Seems like we should all be able to get water. Now, before this big transition happened in Israel, it was basically being paid for by taxation. The city or the municipality people would take a cut of the pay, and that's what kept the water pipes running and things like that. Water should be free. I give you that. But at the same time, there's infrastructure involved. You got to keep up the infrastructure. We got to make sure that the water is getting to you and it's safe. You got to have a place to go and yell at people if they try and put fluoride in your water. I mean, you got to have, there's got to be infrastructure. There's got to be maintenance. There's got to be administration, right? There's got to be some of that stuff. And somebody's got to pay for that because we live in a stupid world where fiat currency seems to run everything. But here's where I stop, because my water bill here at my house where I live, and, you know, as far as I know, my cat's not taking long bubble baths and stuff when I'm not around. So it's just me using water. My water bill is about $45 a month. Okay. That's reasonable. I don't like it. It also, you know, that's also my, I think it pays for my sewer, which is just a hole in the ground as far as I know, but I guess it's maintenance on that, and it's trash. So, okay. I'll pay the $45 a month, but the first bills from the new Irish water utility are due to be sent to households next month, and the protests across the country have already forced the government to make a little concession here, including the abandonment of these pay-as-you-go meters, right? Dublin has introduced a fixed-rate metering system. Listen to this, which charges water. This is absolutely crazy. At 160 euros per month for single households and 260 euros for others. $172 a month for water for a single household. That's absolutely insane. Especially, I can see why these people are so, pardon my French, but peeved right now, because that's crazy to go from not paying anything. And I guarantee you, here's the other side of the coin. I would imagine I'll put money on it, and somebody up there can back me up on this. Do you think their taxes went down? Do you think that the money that would normally be taken out of taxes, do you think their tax rate decreased to make up for the new $172 a month water fee? That's absolutely insane. That is an absolute travesty in terms of a rate increase. So I don't know. I could see these people being out in the streets for that. And again, nearly 100,000 over the water, over this water charge out in the streets of Dublin over the weekend. So here's the, okay, so someone's saying in the UK it was paid for via rates, and now it will still be council tax rates and pay water fees too. So again, yeah, the council tax fee is not going down. Not going to happen. So there you go. Hey, though, there's more protest stuff I want to get to, but I got to talk to this because I know Kev's listening right now, and there's a couple other people from the UK. I love this story. You guys are going to love this story. This is kind of a 9/11 story, but it also is a kind of a UK story, and it has to do with a lawsuit that was just successful there in the UK. So this happened in Horsham, UK. Tony Rourke, who in an act of civil disobedience, he refused to pay the mandatory £130 TV license fee. So in the UK, for you United States listeners or world listeners, you've got to pay a fee just for the benefit or the privilege of having an antenna up at your, on your house in the UK. And it's countrywide. And, again, the license fee, I think that's a yearly fee, but £130 a year so that you can have a television. And they actually do drive around and try and look for people with, you know, illegal antenna. I found out that when I lived there. Don't ask me how. It was somebody else that I knew. Anyway, okay. So this guy, he refused to pay his TV license, and they were going to take him to court. So what did he do? He said, this is the deal, is that paying this fee violates Section 15 of the Terrorism Act. Now, How could that possibly be? His accusation was aimed at the BBC, who reported the collapse of Building 7, you know, World Trade Center Building 7, 20 minutes before it actually fell, and the judge accepted Rourke's argument. So now, while it is not a public inquiry into 9/11, the recognition of the BBC's action on September 11th are considered now to be a small victory and one that was never reported in the United States. So under Section 363 of the Communication Act, communications of the UK are required to purchase an annual license in order to use television receiver. Rourke refused to pay the license fee to because of this section of the Terrorism Act states it is an offense for someone to invite another or to provide money intended that it should be used or having reasonable cause to suspect that it may be used for terrorism purposes. The fact that the BBC reported the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 23 minutes before it actually fell indicates again that the BBC was ultimately aware of the attacks on 9/11 before they actually happened. The direct implication is that they were working with the terrorists, all arguments as to who the terrorists actually were being put aside at this point. But again, you can go find that. If you do not believe me, you can go YouTube. BBC reports collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 early. Twice. Go find that video. There's a woman live on BBC and she's talking about Building 7 just fell. And you can see very clearly behind her Building 7 standing in the background. Oh my gosh. So again, there's a chink in the armor. And here's another important moral to the story, ladies and gentlemen. Don't pay your stupid TV license fees if you're in the UK. Follow this guy's lead and crack this puppy open. I'd go into a class action lawsuit at this point over there if it was me and just sue the crap out of the BBC. I don't know, but anyway, don't pay your license fee. And if they ask you, say, hey, you guys are terrorists, and it's against the law to support terrorists, and I'm not going to be a terrorist, so I can't possibly support you guys. Boom, done. Chink in the armor found by this guy, Tony Rourke, in Horsham, UK. Love it. Anyway, we're going to this break. 3 minutes. Keep it here on TFR, guys. Really appreciate you guys being here. Appreciate you guys in the chat room. Lots more news to come back to. I'm going to talk about CERN here in the next segment, too, because, man, I'll tell you what, scary stuff. 3 minute break, guys. Red Pill Report. We'll be right back. Keep it right here.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
A sudden change in the wind. The day grows dark as ominous clouds move in and lightning begins to carve arcs in the sky. And you realize you are not prepared.
I am telling you to take cover.
The number of intense storms is increasing exponentially in the U.S. Tornadoes, hurricanes, flooding, and droughts are happening with greater magnitude and frequency. If you are choosing to rely on the government to save you,
and no one's coming to help them,
you could be dead wrong. The first step towards self-reliance in the face of disaster is a visit to MyPatriotSupply.com. There you'll find the absolute best prices on storable foods, non-GMO seeds, emergency water filtration devices, and so much more. All orders over $49 qualify for free shipping in the lower 48. Visit us online or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. And speak to one of our preparedness advisors today. Remember, before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com.
nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule 1 drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, and that all men are created equal.
The Freedom Link.
With Joe Joseph, Monday through Friday, on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys very much for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. I missed you all terribly. Daniel Estulin will be my guest in about a half an hour. So definitely tell anybody that you know that might want to find out more about the Bilderberg Group, about what's going on with that group this year, and what potentially some of the agendas that are coming out of that group are. This won't be a show that you want to miss, so get on the horn, get your friends all with you guys gathered around the soft glow of your computer screen, and we'll go over that in about an hour. I want to hop back into a little bit of international news right now, just because there's a lot more protesting that took off over the weekend here. Big anti-government protests happening in the Georgian capital over the weekend also, as well as Dublin. Thousands of people again rallied in the center of Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, calling for the government's resignation there. The march was organized by the party of ex-president Mikhail Saakashvili, I said it right, who was under investigation for corruption and abuse of power right now. The participants of the rally, inspired by the former president's party, the United National Movement, or UNM, marched on Saturday through the center of the city, carrying Georgian, EU, and NATO flags to the Georgian government offices. The activists handed over to the government a symbolic red card and let balloons fly in the air. So again, according to police, number of participants were 10 to 15,000, although the organizers of the event put the number closer to 50,000. And the UNM, an activist, accused the ruling coalition government of mishandling the country's economy, which led to an economic slowdown, a 30% currency devaluation, and increasing inflation and unemployment. The UNM is seeking to start the process of impeachment of the government, MP Sergo Ratiani told journalists, as cited in RIA Novosti over the weekend again. There are some other things I could say about Georgia right now, but I won't say them, but I do recommend you guys go check out this article. Just again, we see more and more people standing up against this imposed rule of the government, but Georgia is one of these unusual places, and you have to wonder, is this actual uprising, or if this is a nurtured George Soros-style uprising? It's just kind of curious there. Also, our guest today, Daniel Estulin, is from Spain, and in Spain, thousands again gathered this weekend in the Spanish capital to protest against the way the government has tackled the financial crisis by implementing harsh austerity measures. They expected about 20,000 to show up. I believe the number ended up being higher than that. The Spanish police deployed about 1,200 officers to monitor the protest, which was called the March of Dignity. According to RT, 9 columns of demonstrators who have been on the march for several days converged in Madrid's Plaza de Colón, which is Columbus Square, for a massive anti-austerity rally. The protesters, gathered by some 300 social action groups and trade unions, are demanding bread, jobs, housing, and dignity from the government. They are also advocating for holding a general strike later in October. So again, more and more countries on the rise at this point. People are just fed up with this austerity nonsense and are ready to be able to, man, I'll tell you, I can't blame them. I cannot blame them at all. It'll be interesting to see what Daniel has to say about what's going on in Spain today. Just as a quick side note here, the foreign prime minister, Sergei Lavrov, is the Russian, again, foreign minister there, condemned another report that came out this weekend, essentially from the West, that was, again, kind of showcasing witnesses saying that a Buk missile had shot down MH17. Lavrov ends up saying that's not at all accurate. He has, in fact, seen reports from witnesses saying that a plane shot MH17 out of the sky with a missile. So, again, Russia still not impressed with the investigation going into the MH17 situation and calling now for, again, independent, unbiased, and professional investigation into MH17. I still wonder what happened to the black boxes that were supposedly gone off to London that we haven't seen for months and months or heard anything about. And again, I would think if you were trying to foment a war with Russia, that would be an ace in the hole. I mean, if you've got actual hardcore evidence that a missile struck that plane, that's pretty irrefutable at this point. And we don't see anybody from the NATO side jumping on that bandwagon too much, do we? Kind of makes you wonder. Okay, we're going to get into some national news here right now, and this is a story that I'm not 100% sure about. But given all of the other stories that we've been talking about recently in which that we're not 100% sure about, again, the disappearance of Putin last weekend was crazy all over the news, but not in mainstream at all. Still a lot of conjecture about what's going on in Russia right now. We had the report, according to the leak from Kaspersky, which is the big, you know, internet security lab there in Russia, that the UK was essentially getting ready to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against military and civilian targets there in Moscow. That story broke Monday, and then obviously we had a lot of story about Russia kind of going on the defensive, huge military drills all across the border, big time escalation. And so you wonder if any of that stuff from behind the scenes, this quote unquote preemptive nuclear strike that was supposed to go down from the UK is accurate. Well, I'm going to tell this story, but again, this is coming from a Russian news source. So let's just bear that in mind as we're listening to this. But there is some backstory, that kind of works in that current of things that are going on behind the scenes or potentially are going on behind the scenes. So anyway, according to a Russian news source, we all almost died last week. We'll just stop right there for just a second. Take a minute, say, oh my gosh, we've been close to nuclear war before. The Georgian thing that happened a few years ago in the Maldives area there. And then also, a lot of people don't know, but I think back in the 60s, the United States accidentally dropped a couple of nuclear bombs on North Carolina. They didn't go off, obviously, because we're all still here having this conversation. But yeah, they dropped a couple just for, you know, oopsies. Oopsies, we almost all died. So, we're always almost close to death. That just seems to be the way it is. And if you watch that show 24, you know, it seems like every 15 minutes something bad is going to happen. But okay. So aside from the fact that we all probably almost died last week, the story has now come out about heroics of a captain. Her name is Heather Cole. She is again, part of the U.S. military organization. She's a captain, Heather Cole. She refused to communicate launch authorization codes to the U.S. nuclear forces, apparently. So again, the U.S. apparently was about to launch a limited nuclear strike against the Russian Federation on Monday with a coordinated surprise attack by the U.K. It is stated now that Captain Cole's action were made possible by the security measures put in place by the former defense chief, Chuck Hagel, prior to his resignation. And she is now reportedly, again, Captain Heather E. Cole, reportedly under arrest and has been relieved of her command. So the EU Times reported this over the weekend. A new report circulating in the Kremlin today, prepared by the Foreign Intelligence Service for the Ministry of Defense, states that President Barack Obama's nuclear war communication commander had been arrested and relieved of her command after failing to transmit launch codes authorizing an atomic weapons first strike attack against the Federation in coordination with a similar surprise attack planned by the United Kingdom. Holy cow. So is it true? I don't know if it's true or not, but if it is true, it makes you appreciate your Monday a little bit more, doesn't it? Okay, so again, according to the Foreign Intelligence Service there in Russia, U.S. Navy Captain Heather E. Cole was the commander of the U.S. Navy Strategic Communications Wing No. 1, located at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma, whose E-63 Mercury aircraft provide the communication links allowing President Obama and U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter to directly coordinate and directly contact the submarines, bombers, and land-based missiles that comprise the United States Strategic Nuclear Force. On Monday, March 16th, this report states that Captain Cole received from the Pentagon a launch order authorizing a limited nuclear attack against the Federation, but which failed due to a critical permissive action link, or PAL, failure, thus causing her to abort this planned attack. As a PAL is a security device for nuclear weapons whose purpose is to prevent unauthorized arming or detonation of said nuclear weapons. SVR experts in this report explain the critical failure in this instance was an added security measure ordered by the former U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel prior to his being forced out of office last month over his refusal to have any part in this attack against Russia. This report further explains that Secretary Carter was not aware of Secretary Hagel's PAL security changes, thus allowing Captain Cole to abort this planned nuclear attack. For her failure to communicate this launch authorization to U.S. nuclear forces, this report continues that Captain Cole was arrested on Tuesday, the 17th of March, relieved of her command, and then taken by armed guards to a U.S. naval air station in Miramar in San Diego, where she remains incommunicado. The SVR in this report on Captain Cole's refusal to start World War III further states that her actions mirror those of Soviet naval captain Vasily Arkhipov, who during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 also refused to obey orders to launch nuclear weapons against the United States. Upon Captain Cole being arrested, an MOD appendix to this SVR report says that President Putin ordered the Federation's strategic nuclear bomber forces to their failsafe locations in the Arctic, which is the fastest air route to the U.S. from Russia. An expansion of the Northern Fleet's combat operations into the Northern Norwegian Sea and continued combat air operations against NATO forces on the northern border. It is important to note that President Putin and the Ministry of Defense have been made aware of this planned nuclear attack against the Federation weeks ago, thus allowing the Federation to move its own nuclear forces to the NATO border. So neither President Putin or the Ministry of Defense have any confidence that President Obama is even in control of his military forces anymore. That's a pretty amazing statement, again, thus necessitating the Federation's greatest defensive war moves since World War II, which, again, is everything that we essentially outlined that was mainstream media all week last week. These huge drills, 50,000 troops in the northern Arctic region there. So anyway, if this is true, that's fairly significant. So I just wanted to put that out there because, again, it does kind of – the Foreign Intelligence Service of Russia doesn't just put out stuff. I mean, maybe they do. We did talk last week about the GCHQ getting ramped up on their anti-Russian propaganda wing. So perhaps it should be, noted here too that the Russians clearly have an anti-NATO propaganda wing that would probably not have just gone into effect, probably has been in effect for a long time. But again, you just don't know what's going on around us right now, and there are all of these stories or threads of stories that seem to be kind of weaving a tapestry of an underlying condition that's going on in the military right now. And for the SVT to come out and say that they're not even sure that the president of our country is in control of its military anymore, that's a pretty big statement, especially if you listen to some of the underground news regarding the CIA going on lockdown the other week, the idea that the CIA has essentially been completely taken over by the military as well. Seems to be a lot of infighting going on right now, and potentially that infighting almost resulted in a full-scale nuclear attack against Russia last week. So again, if it's true, gotta take a minute out and just, go pet your cat or your dog or something, hug your kids, I don't know, just be glad that you're here. Could be a lot worse out there, I guess. Speaking of a lot worse out there, new facial recognition pilot program launched this week by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Civil liberties advocates say could probably lead to new potentially privacy-invading programs. It's just one of the first three biometric experiments the feds are getting ready to launch. So again, this last week, facial recognition pilot program was launched by U.S. Customs and Border officials. It is right now just being operated at Dulles International Airport, but they do look like they're moving forward on a couple of other pilot programs. One of them looks ostensibly like a fingerprint scanner. So anyway, they're going into lockdown mode all across the border. I got to get some more information on this huge drill thing that's going on too. Somebody sent me a couple of articles on this interdepartmental civil service drill that's going to be going on here in the United States. I think it's going to take like 2 months, and it's going to be a big old martial law drill. Essentially, they're looking at how they can coordinate local law, you know, officials and the main big federal agencies and things like that. It's going to be operating in all of the border states, as far as I can tell, going on for 2 months and culminating, coincidentally enough, in the month of September. Probably nothing to see here. Let's just keep moving on. Here's some interesting news about the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. I always forget that, add that E in there. But the director of the BATFE now stepping down following controversy surrounding the agency's proposal to ban certain types of ammunition. The ATF announced Friday that the director, B. Todd Jones, is resigning at the end of the month to pursue other opportunities in the private sector. So again, Jones, who in July of 2013 became the first ATF director to be confirmed by the Senate and led the agency after a scandal involving the agency's infamously botched Operation Fast and Furious gun tracking initiative, is departing shortly after the agency dropped a controversial attempt to ban certain armor-piercing bullets, which are not really armor-piercing, used in AR-15 rifles. So again, they tried to ban it. They were trying to do it by changing some of the exemptions in their little booklet that they put out every single, every 10 years they put a new one out. The exemptions were in the book in 2004, 2005, I can't remember, for this particular green tip bullet for the AR-15. And they printed out a whole bunch of new ones that didn't have that exemption anymore. People went freaking out because they should have. And then the ATF came out and said, oops, it was a publishing error. We're stupid. We know a lot about guns and stuff, but we don't know how to edit anything. And we only had 10 years to work it out, so we couldn't quite pull it off in the end. It just so happens that one particular omission happens to coincide with some of the legislation that we see now trying to work its way through the congressional area there in D.C. But anyway, probably all just a coincidence again, but good news now, ATF director stepping down, and ATF deputy director Thomas Brandon will be taking over as the acting director until the agency finds a new replacement for Jones. Also, over the weekend, a gentleman seen wielding a machete and a bunch of wasp spray attacked a TSA officer at Armstrong International Airport. This happened on Saturday in the pre-boarding line, and then he was shot and killed by police. So according to the sheriff, the man confronted the TSA officer, didn't get the response that he wanted, and then proceeded to spray the officer in the face with wasp spray. Sorry, I don't mean to laugh there. It's comical to me. We outlaw the wasp spray. Eliminate fingers. The incident sent airport workers and passengers in Concourse B to quote-unquote scramble for safety, and the airport was shut down for some time, according to CNN. TSA officer was wheeled away on a stretcher with non-life-threatening injuries after the attack. And police don't know yet if the man who is a taxi driver was a member of the traveling public or just some random psychopath. But again, did go at the TSA guy, did have a machete in his hand, went for the wasp spray instead of the machete, and got shot and died. So there you go. Also, today, I don't know if this is good news or bad news. I'm not really a fan. So Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz reportedly planning to announce today at a Virginia University little speech that he's given that he will be planning to run for president. Be still my beating heart. Please do not forget who his wife is. Heidi Cruz, in charge of the Southwest region of the United States in terms of a little company called Goldman Sachs you might have heard of. So I wonder what they talk about at the dinner table, ladies and gentlemen. I wonder if Goldman Sachs has any kind of leverage against Mr. Cruz, just out of, you know, curiosity. Probably, again, nothing to see here. Moving on, let's see, a couple of big good bills passed this week in Montana and Arizona. blocking federal gun control following Obama's unconstitutional threat of executive order. So earlier this week, two states passed bills that would block enforcement of future federal gun control measures. These states were Montana and Arizona. The Montana bill is going towards the governor's desk right now. But again, this is basically prohibiting, restricting, and requiring individual licensure for ownership, possession, transfer, or use of any firearm or magazine or other ammunition feeding device. So you cannot do any of those things. But it does only apply to federal acts enacted on or after January 1st, 2015. So there's always a caveat in there. But again, lots of states stepping up, doing the right thing. Wow, we're running way out of time here. Let me see if there's anything else super interesting that I need to talk about. 180 million in cocaine caught by some people in Colombia. It's a big time deal there. Immigrants aren't coming to the court cases like they're supposed to. Up 153% of undocumented immigrants not showing up for their hearings. Anybody surprised with that? No. Okay, moving on here. Let's get into some investing news real quick. I'll just blow through this stuff. Dow is up right now, 18.1 and 70. We're up about 42 points. Dollar index is getting spanked a little bit this morning. We're down to 97 and 58. The euro is up at 1.09 and steady. Gold up just a touch today, 11.85. Silver also up. Silver's pretty flat right now, 16.8 and 7. So $16.87 big cents. We'll get you some silver. Let's check out what the oil prices are doing. They're pretty flat. 47 and 5. Is Truth out there to get me my BDI? Nope. You guys are all going to be missing out today. We've talked quite a bit about the Asian Infrastructure Bank, just as a little heads up. I think we talked a little bit Friday on Switzerland getting ready to move over there. Also Luxembourg now getting ready to join. There's another country now also that is getting involved with the Asian structure. What was that other country? I can't remember the name of it. Is the United States of America. Yeah, as of this morning. Just putting that out there also. When you can't beat them, ladies and gentlemen, join them. That's how that song goes. So United States also going to be joining up on that. There's a big old bank run going on. I got to skip some of this economic stuff because, again, all eyes are on Greece right now. We don't know what's going on right now. Some of that contagion has spread to Andorra, which is a tiny mountain-ringed tax haven similar to Luxembourg, and another bank there has essentially gone by the wayside over the weekend. Not a really big bank and not a whole lot of contagion potentially coming out of this, but again, it is a Cyprus-style bail-in that's going on there in Andorra now, so just more contagion spreading across the world. What else? Pakistan is a country you don't hear a whole lot about. Cut their key interest rate over the weekend by 0.5%. They're not into the negative or more negativer interest rates yet, but again, they are trying to bring their inflation under control, so that is important. Also to talk about some great stories about silver potentially coming out here on a major bull run, so that's important. But I really want to go over into some science and tech news because we do need to talk about the Hadron Collider. But first, before we talk about the Hadron Collider, I got to cover this other story because this is just awesome. You guys ever dreamed of owning your own personal flamethrower? And coincidentally, do you live in a state that doesn't end with Ornia? Okay, well, your dream is now about to come true thanks to the wonderful folks over at Ion Productions. You can find them online by looking for Ion Productions and their forthcoming launch of the XM42, which is a hand fire spewing product. According to Engadget, the company plans to launch an Indiegogo campaign for the personal and portable flamethrower that will allow would-be pyromaniacs to acquire one for the low, low bargain basement price of only $700. And the device is reportedly capable of shooting a column of 87-octane flame up to 25 feet, and it can be used to clear weeds, melt snow, combat insects or other pests, UN officials, things like that. On its website, IN Productions explains that the XM42 was created with both aesthetics and performance in mind, and it is based on a prototype originally developed back in 2008. They also describe it as simple to use and also state that it has endless possibilities for entertainment and utility. The XM42 will be available in brushed aluminum for $699 and also could be in a polished aluminum or colored powder coat for $799. But these prices are only good for the early adopters who support the company through their fundraising campaign. So right now, ladies and gentlemen, ground floor, you can get in for a cheap bargain basement price for your very own flamethrower. That's a pretty good deal. So wait a minute, you might be asking, is it even legal for someone to own a flamethrower? Well, in their frequently asked questions page on the company's website, the developers assure us that in most states, it is in fact legal. So again, it sucks to suck California. In California, though, unlicensed possession of any non-stationary transportable device designed or intended to emit or propel a burning stream of combustible or flammable liquid a distance of at least 10 feet is a misdemeanor, punishable by up to 1 year in prison. And licenses can be obtained by the state, from the state fire marshal. However, they probably are pretty rare to get those. Anyway, check with your local laws before ordering. The XM42 team advises, emphasizing that it's up to the customer to understand and abide by all country, state, and local regulations. They added that the device is solely intended for entertainment and utility purposes only, and that currently flamethrowers are a fun toy for responsible adults, and they are useful utility devices. I think I probably need to have one of these. $700 for your very own flamethrower. That seems like a good deal. Okay, we got to talk about this stupid CERN situation as well. There's so much conjecture about there. I'll tell you what, Kev Baker did an awesome article. You can find it over on his page, and he was talking about this again on Friday. But there's a lot of conjecture about these guys potentially trying to open up another dimension or, do something totally crazy like that, right? They're just trying to slam particles together to see what comes out of these particles, right? That's ostensibly what they're doing. Well, no, that's not at all what they're trying to do. This atom smasher in Geneva, Switzerland, gonna be fired up. And I believe the actual fire up date, ladies and gentlemen, is today. So, if successful, this completely new universe will be revealed. This is what they're saying in science magazines right now. So they're not talking about rewriting not only the physics books, but also philosophy books. Listen to the language they're talking about. They say it is even possible that gravity from our own universe may leak into a parallel universe. They are going out specifically trying to open up a gate into a parallel universe to see if they can discover physics from a different universe. This is crazy. Again, the experiment is sure to inflame alarmist critics like myself. So far, Geneva does in fact remain intact and comfortably outside of the event horizon. But the LHC has been spectacularly successful so far, and this week's experiment is considered to be a game changer. One of the three strong team of physicists behind the experiment says just as many parallel sheets of paper, which are two-dimensional objects, breadth and length, can exist in a third dimension, parallel universes can also exist in higher dimensions. So when you ask yourself what these guys are trying to do, they really are looking for extra-dimensional universes here, ladies and gentlemen, so that they can discover the physics. Now, what's going to happen if they open up a gate to another dimension in the middle of Switzerland? I don't know, but they're getting ready to do it this week. I'm sure it will be the discussion of many, many, many conversations to come. But just wanted to point that out, that if you see a large black hole approaching you from the general direction of Geneva, well, it'll be a fun ride. I'll see you guys on the other side. Speaking of other sides, we've got to go to a 3-minute break. When we come back, Daniel Eschelin will be joining us, and we're going to be talking about Bilderberg. Keep it right here, guys. 3-minute break.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR. Did you know that the blue lotus flower was used by the ancient Egyptians as an aphrodisiac to experience feelings of euphoria and ecstasy? And ecstasy. And ecstasy. Did you know that Thai kratom was used by the Buddhist monks to produce a relaxing and dreamlike state? Did you know San Pedro cactus was used by the Native Americans to quest for visions and heal the body? Bouncing Bear Botanicals is your number one supplier of rare and sacred plants and a proud sponsor of Truth Frequency Radio. By clicking on the banner at truthfrequencyradio.com, you can learn more about a vast selection of entheogens, including Amanita muscaria, also known as the sacred mushroom. So click on the banner at truthfrequencyradio.com, and you'll also get up to $40 off your next order.
Archaeology, astronomy, alchemy, secrets of the Holy Bible, hidden codes of the Quran, demonology, Tesla technology, solar power, extraterrestrials in the ancient world. More than 500 documentaries, an experimental film lab of cutting-edge music and art, full-length movies, conference reports, and weekly TV shows. The Enigma Channel is the world's first truly global TV station. www.enigmatv.com. Intelligent television for planet Earth.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
The wicked ones obviously under heavy Masonic influence.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys very much for hanging out with us through that 3-minute break. And thank all of you guys who are in the chat room right now. Really appreciate you guys being in there. And we love the format here at Truth Frequency. So you guys have an opportunity to get your questions in there for our guests. And I got to be honest, ladies and gentlemen, the guys behind the scene, Robert and Fletch, have done it again today. We kind of went out with the idea that we wanted to learn about the Bilderberg Group. So essentially, the guys went out and they got the world's foremost authority on said group and brought him onto the program today. It's very, very exciting for me because I'm actually a huge Daniel Estulin fan, just as a side note. So to be bringing him and his experience in the world to you guys is just absolutely humbling to me. So for those of you guys who don't know who Daniel Estulin is, I would first recommend going to danielestulin.com, which is his website. A little heads up, it does originate in Spain, so some of you guys, if you're listening here in the States, will probably have to translate it. But it is an absolutely outstanding site, and at that site you can find out everything you could possibly want to know about Daniel. But just as a nutshell, I gotta tell you, he is an award-winning investigative journalist. He's an international best-selling author, and he has recently been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. How often, ladies and gentlemen, do we get an opportunity to speak to Nobel Peace Prize nominees? He is also a man who's been in the crosshairs of the global power brokers for almost 2 decades now. He is our preeminent historian of the global elite, a scholar of remarkable breadth and erudition, and one of the world's most outspoken public intellectuals. He does not mince words, and he does not hold back when it comes to naming names and identifying when cauldrons of chaos that these people have created. So over the last 20 years, he has exposed these and other shadow masters among the secret global power elite as the coolly vicious orchestrators of war, terrorism, drug trafficking, and theft on a very grand scale. So it is with absolute humility and humbleness that I welcome Mr. Daniel Estulin to the program today. Daniel, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today.
After such an introduction, I'm not sure if I should be nervous. Thanks so much for the invitation, and it's great to be on the show.
Well, I really appreciate you being here. And again, there are so many of these issues that are swirling around these days, Daniel. I mean, to say that the agenda is multifaceted would be very, very, would be an understatement, to say the least. And so one of the things we do here at Red Pill Reports, obviously, as the name suggests, is we try and outline different facets of the matrix, try and figure out where this collusion and control mechanism really stems from. And you really couldn't get closer to the source than your work on the Bilderberg Group, as far as I'm concerned. And again, the book that you've produced, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, really is probably arguably the foremost authority on the Bilderberg Group at this point out in the world. So information, ladies and gentlemen, if you want more information on the Bilderberg Group, that book is going to be something you absolutely have to add to your collection. But for people out there, again, and I have to say this because I ran into somebody the other day, Daniel, who still had not put the pieces together about 9/11. We were having a very large discussion, and he was just honestly kind of coming to the realization that there was more going on with 9/11 than met the eye. So it's imperative to understand that we, people like you and myself, have not reached the saturation point. There are still people out there who've never heard of the Bilderberg Group, who have absolutely no idea who these people are. And so that's why we really want to kind of start with a 101-style class here. So if you would, sir, give us a little bit of the history of the Bilderberg Group and how you became so interested in it that you felt like you needed to write such a great book about it, sir.
You know, back in 1992, I think it was, I was having lunch with a friend of mine in Toronto and in Canada. And, you know, he was telling me over this lunch in a Spanish restaurant of the events that allegedly were going to take place 3 years in the future in 1995. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about the alleged separation of French-speaking Canada and English-speaking Canada into two Canadas, and English-speaking Canada merging with the United States into becoming this greater North America. Well, needless to say, when you hear this kind of stuff for the first time, whether we're talking about 9/11, Bilderberg, you know, the separation of Quebec or any of these other shenanigans that go on behind the scenes, It's kind of startling, you know, for anyone. And you kind of looked at this guy and I asked him a few questions and he humored me with some answers, you know, and we parted ways and that was that. And 3 years later in 1995, suddenly all this, you know, this 2.5 hour conversation we had over lunch, which seemed really funny at the time, all these individuals began, you know, appearing on the television screen, people I've never heard of before, you know, started parading in front of us, giving us their opinion on the near future separation of Quebec independence drive. And suddenly I realized that you had, these unelected individuals from, you know, the extreme right and the extreme left and, you know, just anyone from the political spectrum. And the president of the United States, Clinton at the time, and you know, Jean Chrétien was the prime minister of Canada. They're making all kinds of noises, but they weren't driving the, you know, the rhetoric. It was being driven, the agenda was being driven by someone else. And I saw how powerless this entire, you know, establishment seemed, at least on the surface, of changing the dynamic of, you know, what looked very much like to be the end of Canada as a nation state. And it would have been the end had it not been for a very small group of Canadian citizens, you know, from across the country who got on buses, went to Quebec and spent, I don't know, a month, I think, before the referendum in 1995, trying to convince the Quebecois, the people in Quebec, that, you know, the rest of Canada really loved them and they didn't want them to leave. We wanted them, you know, to stay in Canada. But, and, you know, and they succeeded. The people who wanted Quebec to stay in Canada won by a margin of 0.5%, less than 1%. And so I kind of realized at the time that, if these prime ministers and presidents really didn't preside over anything, then who the hell, you know, ruled the world from behind the scene? Mm-hmm. And that's how I kind of got into this because this individual told me about this, you know, private organization called Builder something or other. And, you know, I couldn't quite pronounce the name. It sounded German to me. In the end, it turned out to be Dutch. But basically, you know, the Bilderberg Group is the name of the hotel, Bilderberg Hotel, in Oosterbeek on the outskirts of Amsterdam, which is the capital city of the Netherlands, Holland, where the Bilderbergers met for the first time, this organization. They met for the first time in 1954. And they call themselves the Bilderberg Group, which is basically your former NATO alliance, Canada, United States, and Western Europe. Bilderberg was a very important element of the oligarchical structures of the Cold War period. And that in and of itself is a pretty significant factor because what it meant is that this organization was a vehicle through which private financier oligarchical interests were basically able to impose their policies on what is nominally governments, independent governments. And, you know, the idea behind each and every Bilderberg meeting is to create what they themselves call the aristocracy of purpose between European and North American elites are the best place to manage the planet.
Wow.
And the way that the whole thing was organized is that in the early 1950s, you know, at the end of the Second World War, the top European elite circles worked with a selected group of American elitists, you know, billionaires such as David Rockefeller, for example, to form the, you know, this Bilderberg organization in an effort to bring together the most influential people from both sides of the Atlantic and to advance the cause of Atlanticism or globalism.
Right.
You know, and the list, you know, the list of attendees, there were the usual suspects, top politicians, international businessmen, bankers, you know, leaders of think tanks and foundations, diplomats, media moguls, you know, European heads of states. And the first couple of meetings, because, you know, they didn't know where the money would come from, was actually financed by the CIA. And this came out a few years back when a friend of mine, a Dutch researcher by the name of Gerald Alders, uncovered, you know, some pay stubs in the, you know, the National Archives where, you know, CIA right there had their signature on documents which showed that they financed the first couple of Bilderberg meetings.
Wow.
In 1954 and 55.
Wow. How long were they able to keep this thing secret? You know, how long were they operating until somebody like you said, hey, wait a minute, we need to focus on this?
Well, you know, it's, you know, I came late to the scene. I started following them around since about 1995. Before that, you know, Jim Tucker has been doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, he died a couple of years ago, God bless his soul. And,
right.
You know, he was doing it for 30 years. And before Jim, in the 60s, you had, Spotlight, you know, magazine, you know, they were doing it, you know, back in the early 1960s. So, you know, people found out, you know, pretty much, within, you know, the first decade, they kept it, you know, very, very quiet and secretive for the first few years, but, you know, it eventually came out. And, but I think what I was able to do is, you know, I think I brought some, you know, sense of, you know, logic and reason to it, staying away from the conspiracy theories, you know, to the point where, you know, when I started publishing stuff and the book first came out in 2005 and, it was published by a small American publisher, Trinity Press. And, you know, immediately when it came out in Spain, and then Spain became a, you know, mega bestseller. And,
right.
You know, but what I did was I basically made it cool for people to talk about Bilderberg without being looked at as some, you know, nutty conspiracy theories because, you know, I brought over 200 pages of documents and photographs, stuff that I found and uncovered myself. And I attended these meetings over the years. Obviously not on the inside, on the outside looking in.
Right.
But I was able to photograph all these people and bring it out and show, you know, the world that they exist, that they do meet, and the fact that you have such a tremendous collection of very powerful individuals who can actually get together with impunity and discuss in private and in secret world politics and the decisions that they made over, you know, the years of this Bilderberg meetings. I show how they basically, you know, changed the very dynamic of society, certainly made it, you know, possible for people to read this stuff and, you know, take it seriously instead of just looking at it some, you know, wacky conspiracy.
Oh, yeah.
They could just they talk about, you know, the UFOs and, you know, some, you know, Sasquatches and the, you know, snowmans and all this kind of stuff.
Hey, let's not knock the Sasquatch, okay? Just because they don't get a vote in Congress, then it doesn't mean they're not real.
There was a cartoon back in, you know, I was born in the Soviet Union, and there was a cartoon about this lovable Sasquatch, and they used to watch it, you know, every Sunday morning. So, yeah, I love Sasquatches. I just don't want to have it in my book.
I agree. And that's one of the points I'd love to make about your book is that it's very much like a textbook. I mean, we're talking about, it's just got a slew of just photocopied documents in it. I mean, this isn't conjecture. This is like, this is the meeting and all of the attendees and this is the official letterhead. I mean, you've got all of that in there plus all of the pictures of the attendees. It's not a conspiratorial study. It's a, hey, there's these people and they happen. Is it a once a year meeting, Daniel, that they do this?
It's a once-a-year meeting. They meet usually in May. And, you know, again, it's when we are talking about conspiracy theories, no? It's important for people to understand that it's not that, you know, Bilderberg Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, Pinay Circle, Bohemian Grove, you know, Hoover Institute, Hudson, you know, Ford, Rockefeller, you know, Foundation, Carnegie Endowment for Peace all of these international organizations, you know, and multinationals and NGOs, et cetera, it's not like, you know, they rule the world from behind the scenes. They're not the seats of power. They're conveyor belts. The real decision-making processes are, you know, are conducted at much, much higher levels. But what is absolutely true is that these meetings do have, you know, a purpose in this, you know, international juggernaut of how things work from behind the scenes. But again, said that, it would be, you know, completely wrong to assume that in this 1 3.5-day meeting, you know, these 120 individuals decide how the world is going to run.
Right.
These things don't work like that. The world is a very complex place. It's not like you have four old geezers sitting in a dark room holding hands, staring at a crystal ball planning the world's domination. It's not like that at all. But what basically does happen is that when you kind of look at all these meetings that take place during a 12-month period, beginning in January, which is, you know, first important meeting is Davos at the end of January, early February in Switzerland. Then you have the trilateral commission meetings, regional and you know, and general Council on Foreign Relations. Then you have in April G7 meeting. Then in May you have the Bilderbergers meet. You know, in June again you have the trilateral commission Europe meeting. In September, International Monetary Fund World Bank meeting. In October, you have, you know, and between you have European Council of Ministers, President meets with his advisors, you know, congressmen and senators and, you know, and commissions all over the world. They meet and they sit down and they discuss whether it's, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, European Central Bank, Federal Reserve. They all, you know, all this kind of stuff is conducted, you know, behind closed doors. I think there's no one out there who thinks that these people should be, meeting in private because they shouldn't. You know, all these meetings are conducted behind closed doors for a reason. They don't want us to know what they're talking about.
Right.
But what is absolutely certain, and this is important to understand, is that you have this, you know, a consensus emerge at these meetings. And this consensus is kind of carried and driven through, you know, the agendas of all these other organizations. And basically it's kind of invisible international consensus emerges and goes from one meeting to the next, but no one is really leading. It's not like we have this big, you know, Eminem's Grease with this big scar on his face as you see in Hollywood films. But the consensus reached at Davos and passed on to, you know, trilateral commission meetings and Council of Foreign Relations and Bilderbergers and G7 and, you know, and G20 and International Monetary Fund, World Bank, Bank meetings and Federal Reserve Board meetings. It becomes, you know, the background for example, G7 economic communique, and it becomes what informs the International Monetary Fund, what it imposes an adjustment program on Argentina, Nigeria, you know, Ecuador, and also becomes what the American president proposes to Congress, and it becomes what, you know, the president of the European Commission proposes to the European Parliament, and suddenly it's on the cover of every newspaper in Europe, and suddenly it becomes law on the European level. But it was first proposed maybe 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years ago, and, you know, it works itself to becoming law, to be, you know, to following objectives of the supranational elite. And this consensus, you know, again, reached, is simultaneously promoted by all these all-powerful political and commercial interests through the mainstream press, which plays a very important role in all these meetings, because they're part and they're sworn to secrecy. And anybody who thinks that, you know, New York Times is of this world and Washington Post and Foxes, et cetera, are independent, you know, don't have your head on straight, because they, you know, they answer to somebody who pays them their salary.
Yep.
And that individual answers to the board of directors, who answers, you know, to the shareholders. And the shareholders is your military industrial complex, which is how, you know, you can never get the real story out there. And that's how it works.
Well, and I appreciate that perspective, because I think that that's very important to understand, that most of the agenda in terms of international politics and geopolitics stems from these meetings, not necessarily just the Bilderberg, but again, you know, all of these elites spend a lot of time meeting throughout the years at different locations and are constantly talking about things and trying to kind of massage the world into the direction they'd like to see it go. I do want to just ask, while we're on the subject of the Bilderberg group, because it's always been a curiosity to me, to think about, you know, you're getting 250 or 300 or so of the most powerful, you know, wealthy, people in the world together for this meeting. Somebody's got to take charge of the meeting and set some sort of agenda, if there is an agenda. Is there I know you've already said that the strings are being pulled from a higher source, but I'm just wondering, in terms of the actual Bilderberg meeting, is there somebody that actually sets an agenda? Is there a council of people that are actually superior to everyone else? Or how does the inner workings of the meeting actually work, if you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, you know, again, Bilderberg is your former NATO alliance, Western Europe, Canada, United States, American delegation. That's usually about a third of all the delegates, about, you know, 40, 45 people come from the United States. And then you have large European nations such as Germany, then, you know, they would provide 6-7 delegates. Spain, you know, Portugal, Greece, these small countries, Denmark and so on, you know, you have like 2 or 3 delegates. You know, Canada would have, you know, more in line with, you know, with Germans, as far as, you know, importance. But generally America is 1/3, the rest of, you know, the attendees, that's about 2/3 of the delegates. And out of those, you have the board of directors, let's just call them that, okay? Well, you have, you know, the president, which at the time is right now, is Etienne Davignon, who is one of the very important ex-members of European government or European Commission. And then you have the American chair, which is up until recently, you know, was chaired by David Rockefeller. Now he's too old. He's going to be 100 in a couple of months.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, it's like the evildoers never die.
I know, right? How's that guy made it to 100? I mean, seriously.
Well, because, you know, I think, you know, I think it's in the genes, right? But, you know, he's going to be dead soon. You know, I know that. It's just a question of, you know, whether he's going to be dead now or in a year from now. But, right. You know, he ain't making it to 200, that's for sure.
God, I can only hope, man.
You know, I wouldn't want my grandchildren saying, well, yeah, he's going to be dead soon. He's only 200.
Right?
And somebody's going to come out and say, see, I told you, he's like a lizard man from outer space.
I'm still, the jury's still out on that, for me, to be honest. If he, I mean, 100, think about what that guy has been through to make it this far. He could be a lizard.
I don't believe in that nonsense, but you know, it's like, I guess that's why I get nominated for Nobel, because they take it seriously what I do. But the thing is that, you know, you have the European chair, you have the American chair, you have the commission, there's about 12 people more or less. And, you know, then on top of the, you know, below the commission, every country has a Bilderberg delegate. In other words, somebody who is, you know, in the position of power, who has influence and power and knows everybody on, you know, on a national level. And what they do is yearly, they submit the names to the commission of, you know, 5 or 10 people as potential candidates to assist, you know, to attend this year's meetings. And it's also strategically decided, you know, so you have maybe an up and coming, you know, politician, you have a union leader who's making a lot of noise, and, you know, they have to be not convinced, not scared to death, not killed, but brought on board, because that's how this stuff works. So, you know, when I hear people say Bilderberg ordered, you know, somebody killed or, you know, it's stupid, you know, people talk like that. Right. It's really stupid. I mean, how is Bilderberg going to order the president of the United States, who has the biggest, you know, nuclear arsenal in the world, to do something? That's the kind of stuff that normal people will ask. And unless you can explain to them, they're going to take you for a fool, which is one of the reasons I don't talk about this kind of stuff, because it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. What does make sense is influence. And you can influence decision making. And so, you know, you have these national boards or national directors, I guess you'd call them, or representatives, who, you know, who send 10 people, 8 people, 12 people, you know, very detailed descriptions of who they are and what they can offer to the meeting. And you know, out of these, depending on the necessities of the moment, you get to choose 2 or 3 or 4, depending on the country. And so usually you get, you know, the leading media representatives always attend Bilderberg conferences. Then you have an important politician, and also you have an important, you know, economist or a businessman from smaller countries. And for bigger countries, you have obviously a lot more clout, so you have a lot more delegates. And that's how that stuff usually works. And needless to say, they discuss, they disagree, they do all kinds of stuff, because just think of it as a family, you know. But generally speaking, it's important to understand that a lot of this stuff, again, is done through consensus. And if you kind of go back and look throughout history, the kinds of people attended these meetings, it's always been this, you know, this mesh of individuals who have links to other people. For example, you know, if you go back to the original Bilderberg meetings from in the 1960s, on the American side, you know, those who were very prominent in the formation of the Bilderbergers were David Rockefeller, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, Deed Rusk, who was a top official with Council on Foreign Relations, which is a brother organization to the Bilderbergers in the United States. And at the time, you know, Rusk was the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. Also, Joseph Johnson was in on, you know, the initial creation of the Bilderberg Group. That's another Council on Foreign Relations member. And he was the head of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, another Rockefeller organization. Then you had, you know, John J. McLaughlin. He was the another council member and also the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, which is a Rockefeller, you know, bank. And a chairman of the board of the Ford Foundation, which is, you know, a Rockefeller organization. So you had all these people who are basically from different, you know, walks of life, but they're all working together and tied to, you know, influential, very influential. That, you know, in America, you had major American foundations such as the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fords. They were so pivotal in the origins of the Bilderberg Group. It's not a coincidence at all. You know, the foundations throughout the 20th century have been the central institutions in constructing consensus amongst the elites and also creating consent, you know, to power. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, you could call them the engines of social engineering, both for the elite circles specifically and society as a whole. More generally. And, you know, that's how this stuff works. It's logical, really, if you think about it. And you hear a lot of people talk about, you know, these people are meeting in private and secret and, you know, they shouldn't be there, Logan Act. Yeah, but, you know, everyone always meets in secret.
That's right.
You know, if you don't meet in secret, you are nobody. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's like no, you know, I've never seen the president of the United States or the president, I don't know, of Miami Heat meet with his people to decide on who they're going to, you know, select in next year's draft and have that open to the public. And it's just stupid. So everybody meets in secret because that's how they protect the information. I'm not defending it in this particular sense.
No, no.
You know, this particular case. But I'm saying that it's absolutely logical. So go beyond that and understand how this kind of, you know, links and relationships work together towards, you know, pushing a particular agenda mm-hmm. of a very, you know, minute, you know, cross-section of the population against the interests of the rest of society.
Right. But I think what's important to talk about is, and why I think it's important that you bring up those points, not that we're saying that what they're doing is, you know, something we condone, but it's important to understand that it's still going on. And then once you strip away all the conspiratorial elements, you can actually look at logically what it is that they're doing and understand that they, yes, in fact, still are relevant today. And so that we should probably still continue to be paying attention to what they're doing. Daniel, we've got to go to a quick 3-minute break. Again, ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Estulin is our guest today. I hope you guys are enjoying this show. We're going to go to this 3-minute break, and when we come back, I just want to peruse the topics of whether or not or where the new meeting is going to be this year and what potentially might the agenda be for this meeting coming up here this year. And then I want to talk to you about the film project that you're working on as well, because I'm really interested
okay.
in that.
Thank you.
Of course. So again, ladies and gentlemen, 3-minute break. Keep in the stake around in the chat room. If you guys have questions for Daniel Estulin, that will be a great place to stick them. And we'll be right back in just a few minutes. Keep it right here, guys. Red Pill Reports Radio Broadcast.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN. Worldwide.
Sure, I'm glad I tried that new Iodine Now microplant powder formulation.
You liked it, huh? I told you it would change your life.
Yeah, I feel fantastic, and I have so much more energy.
Hi, I have your Iodine Now delivery.
Oh, yes, my second order arrived. Thank you so much.
Hey, buddy, why don't you ask this lady out for a date?
Good idea. Now that I'm taking Iodine Now, I have the energy to enjoy my life again.
It looks like you're getting back your old charm, buddy.
I'd love to go out to dinner with you. And can I try some of the Iodine Now?
Of course you can. You just delivered me a 1-year supply.
Your future looks really great.
I finally agree with you.
Iodine Now, part of the Microplant Powder family. Microplant Powder is available in 15 different formulations. Call 888-910-4367 or visit the website to find the one that's right for you. And listen to our new audio descriptions for every product only at HealthUSA.org.
We all know the importance of having storable foods, but what about when the food runs out? What then? For real food independence, you need a supply of non-hybrid seeds. Introducing the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. The Survival Seed Vault is sealed for freshness and includes 20 varieties of easy-to-grow non-hybrid seeds for only $37.95. For less than $40, you've got real food independence. And the Survival Seed Vault includes detailed planting and seed-saving instructions. Imagine the barter power you'll have when the food supply does collapse. Right now, save $9 instantly when you buy 3 or more Survival Seed Vaults from MyPatriotSupply.com. Same day shipping on all orders, plus free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness products at MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com.
Radio
Welcome back to the broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys very much for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. And those of you guys hanging out in the chat room, really appreciate you guys being in there as well. Somebody pester Kevin for me. Absolutely TFR royalty hanging out in the chat room right now. And probably all here because they wanted to hear from Daniel Estulin today. And again, ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Estulin is our guest today. And you can go to danielestulin.com, danielestulin.com. And you can find out more information about him and some of the other things that we're going to be talking about here coming up. Daniel, before the break, we were talking obviously about the Bilderberg Group and about your absolutely fantastic book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. And essentially the fact that it is almost a textbook-style book that you can just cultivate incredible amounts of information that you've gotten into this book. And we were talking about the continued relevance of the Bilderberg Group and how essentially the agenda kind of flows through that group and a bunch of other similar type groups. But I wonder, before we get on to a different topic here, if you could just touch on any information that you've got about this year's meeting, any potential attendees that you might be aware of or a potential agenda that might be coming out of this year's meeting, sir.
Not yet. Just about now, they're probably be looking at the cutting the initial list of about 200 potential candidates to about 120, 130. You mentioned earlier in the show that, you know, the information just came out. Actually, I published the information in October 2014 because I have a source in the Austrian Ministry of Interior, and they sent me the official document from the ministry referring to the Bilderberg Group meeting in June 2015 and basically explaining the rules to all the people in the ministry that, you know, the vacation period is off until the Bilderberg meeting is finished, saying that they're very concerned about Islamic, you know, terrorism being present during the meeting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're going to have extra security. And again, the information itself came out in October. And, you know, I think people right now are becoming aware that the meeting is, you know, literally just around the corner. But, you know, you're going to have your typical candidates who always attend the Marie-José Kravis, who was the senior fellow at Hudson, you know, her husband. Henry Kravis was one of the, you know, senior partners at KKR Investment. Kissinger, you know, health permitting, he's going to be there. You know, Brzezinski, he might come as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have mostly European royalty as well. Princess Beatrix, before she was known as Queen Beatrix, the daughter of the founder, Prince Bernard, you know, she always comes to this meeting. The Spanish queen, or former queen, Sophia, she's probably going to be there as well. So, you know, you're going to have these kinds of individuals. Again, it's Canada, the United States, Western Europe. Since the breakup, of the, Warsaw Pact alliance, a lot of these, former Warsaw Pact nations, they've been incorporated, into the Bilderberg structure, but not as countries, only occasional individual, basically, you know, people who are traitors to their nation state.
Right.
They attend these meetings, you know, and, you know, you have an occasional Russian. People who obviously have very little to do with Russia as a country would like to see it destroyed. You know, they come to these kinds of things. But, it's again, it continues to be 9% former, NATO alliance and, you know, with an occasional, you know, traitor from Eastern, you know, bloc nations brought in, as, you know, potential future candidate that they look at and see if they, you know, if it's worthy of their support or not.
Well, and I know that you're probably a lot like us in thinking that the most that we can really do in terms of trying to fight back against these people and these agendas is just to continue to expose them, trying to get more and more people on board and understanding just what is going on around us. And I know you've kind of got a new project that you've got working on here right now. And as I understand it, it kind of stems from this book. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah, it's a documentary film called The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. It's one of the few films actually out there that are based on a book. And we started working on this documentary 5 years ago when an American producer, you know, with excellent connections to Hollywood, really wanted to read my book, loved the book, and wanted to make a film about it. And, you know, he basically was scared into walking away from the project. And, whoever scared the hell out of him, you know, now he's making, you know, love films, with Jennifer Aniston. I'm serious.
I believe.
You know, and these kinds of people. And, you know, he just walked away. He said, I can't do this. He said, you're getting phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning from people saying, sir, walk away from this project.
Right.
And, you know, he said, I have family, I have kids. And he walked away. And then we had a European producer who had a lot of money. And he also, you know, loved the book and he wanted to get into this. And, if you believe in conspiracy or coincidence theories, you know, three banks called in his loans on the same day and other projects that he was involved in and basically wiped them out.
Right.
That's when I said, you know, enough is enough. And, you know, I made, you know, money with my book worldwide. And, you know, I said, you know, let's make this. Let's, you know, let's just do this. And, I put over $200,000 of my own money into this project, and it's been in the making for 4 years, and we've, you know, traveled to 11 countries. We've interviewed some amazing people. We've been to Canada and the United States and, you know, England and the Netherlands and, you know, Brussels and Belgium, the European Parliament, and Germany and Russia, Italy, Spain, France, Portugal. I'm sure I missed a few in between, but, you know, it's been a long slog, and now we're at the end of it, and we're running out of cash. So, you know, we've started this campaign at Rocket Hub, which is a crowdfunding site. Mm-hmm. And we're asking people to help us out. You know, if you can give us $5-$10 to get this film over and done with, just go there, type in Bilderberg, and, you know, you get some nice prizes. But, it's, you know, the reason, it's not that we, you know, we're going to finish this film, whether we get this additional help or not. But what we're doing is we want this film, you know, to be eligible for Oscars and for all the top films out there. So we're bringing in absolutely top specialists in the world, you know, sound engineers, you know, color specialists, people who are going to tweak this and make this into a wow kind of experience. And that's why we need this a little bit extra money, because a lot of them are, you know, giving of their time, but still, you know, they can't work for free, obviously, and nobody does. And so the idea is that if you can help us out, go to a crowdfunding site called Rocket Hub and help us out. And, you know, and I think it's the right time in history because, you know, you see like Ed Snowden, Citizen 4 won Oscar for the best documentary this year. Mm-hmm. And, it's just that moment where people are aware more than ever before. And, you know, because of internet, because of, you know, telecommunications, because of this instant communications out there, we know immediately what happens in Ferguson and how that affects, you know, people who live in Ukraine and, you know, how that affects what's happening in Spain and Italy and so on and so forth. And so this global awareness is just that moment where these kinds of films as the Bilderberg documentary or any other film, you know, had it not been made by me, would have been the kinds of things you want to support, because it really brings out into the open what these, you know, individuals are doing to us. And it's, you know, unless we do something about it now, there may not be time in the future, because, you know, the divide between their wealth and power and their technology and us is getting greater than ever.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be growing, you know, that disparity seems to be growing moment by moment anymore. I mean, especially when you start looking at the economy, the haves versus the have nots is getting pretty despairing at this point.
Let me give you an example what you're saying. For example, at the Davos meeting, which took place in January, at the end of January, beginning of February in Switzerland, and, you know, people might have heard of Davos. It's your first really important international meeting. But there's a public Davos where you have like people like Bono and Madonna, right. You know, these freaks, you know, who sit there with some African tribal chief who's dressed in this, you know, orange gown with, you know, little feathers in his hair. And, you know, they talk to the president of the United States and everybody says, oh, that's so nice that everybody's sitting there trying to get along. Well, this is, you know, for public consumption. The real Davos, the one, you know, you don't see, and the one that's important, is behind the scenes Davos, where these people, not the Bonos who are nobodies, you know, but the real people who run the world from behind the scenes, they use these meetings to start molding what later will be policies which you'll be seeing on television, reading about in the newspapers. And they kind of get it out into the open and see the reaction of the audience. And they kind of, you know, mold it and shape it and tweak it and, you know, push it off to the next meeting of these organizations. And one of the things that they discussed, and it's important because you'll see it in the media soon, at this year's Davos in January, is a term called fiscal austerity. Okay, now everybody knows what it means, and everybody thinks it's a nice term, which basically says that the government, for once, are gonna do what they have to do, and tighten the belt, and not waste all these billions of dollars on stupid programs and try to, you know, spend that money, you know, putting it into important programs. Well, no, it doesn't work like that. Fiscal austerity, if you're looking from the point of view of the elite, it basically means, you know, cutting social spending and increasing taxes. Huh? And the effect that this has, and this is what they talked about, is that the public sector will be devastated. All assets will be privatized. Public workers, you know, will be fired en masse. And unemployment becomes rampant, health and education disappear, taxes rise dramatically, and currencies are destroyed to make all assets cheaper for the international globalists basically to buy up, while, you know, internally causing inflation, which dramatically increasing the, you know, the costs of fuel and food. And basically, fiscal austerity implies social destruction as the social foundation of nations and people pulled out from under them. And you know, if you kind of look at what it means short term, is that basically, you know, it will hit the middle class harder than anyone else, and it will vanish completely into obscurity. And basically the middle class will be absorbed into lower labor oriented working class. And, you know, and if you look at the youth of Western middle class, and, you know, I don't even talk about Spain and Portugal and Greece and Italy, where you have 65-70% unemployment. Wow. For kids, you know, it's absolutely, you know, mind-boggling, staggering, that if you kind of think about it, these are educated youth, you know, who played by the rules, went to school, you know, saved their money, went out and, you know, rented an apartment, you know, didn't do drugs and, you know, didn't smoke or drink and wanted to have a life. And, you know, they will be exposed to this poverty of expectations, in which these kids grew up in a world in where they were literally promised everything, and from whom absolutely everything, you know, down to their, you know, shoelaces was so quickly taken. And needless to say, the, you know, the inevitability of riots, protests, you know, rebellion is as sure as the sun rises, whether it's in Spain, in Greece, in the United States, or anywhere in the world. And, you know, Brzezinski foresaw this back in the 70s and the 90s when he talked, you know, about the technotronic revolution as, you know, a major geopolitical development at the end of the 20th century.
You know, I want to talk about Spain right now, but I'm struck by what you're saying and its relationship to what I'm watching going on in the Ukraine right now. A lot of people, especially here in our country, have no idea what the status or the standard of living was like in the Ukraine before all of this, ridiculousness happened there, with NATO going in and essentially, you know, using, funds from George Soros or George Soros type organizations to, destabilize the people and the hearts of the minds. But, you know, the last week they came out and said that they've created this new board, which was the, this agency for the modernization of the Ukraine. And I always have to remind people that we're talking about white people that lived in townhouses that had better internet than we do here in the United States. And the fact that we would be so audacious now to say that we need to modernize, quote unquote, their society after driving the hryvnia down in value by 60% or so. It just seems like this is a template that we can almost watch being applied around the world. Wouldn't you agree with that, Daniel?
It's absolutely very good, analysis. You know, the issue between Russia and the United States and NATO is not actually Ukraine. It's the determination of governments that are under the thumb of the London Wall Street financial oligarchy to crush any sovereign opposition to their power. And, you know, the powerful nations committed to defending national sovereignty, especially as the cases in Russia and China, are, you know, de facto the enemies of this system. And, you know, any lies necessary to justify that designation will be and are being used. And, you know, the truth is being overwhelmed by this torrent of lies about Russian aggression, suppressing the real story of the coup d'etat in Ukraine, mm-hmm. the Nazi nature of these, you know, coup plotters, and the strategic intentions also behind the scenes, you know. And if you kind of, you know, look at the Ukraine, you look at it geographically, throughout history, every invader had to come through Ukraine to get to Russia because it is the easiest access to Russia. I mean, you can get to Russia through Japan, but, you know, probably easier to get it, you know, through Ukraine. And if you look at the pipelines, you will notice that so many pipelines also go through Ukraine. You know, the West has had little luck getting Russian oil companies under their control because Putin took control of that once he became president. But, you know, even going back to 1995, to the days post loans for shares when, you know, 40% of Russia, you know, was literally wiped out and all their savings were wiped out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the West can get to the oil companies. So the transport routes are becoming even more important, you know, and with the building of the North Stream and the interrupted construction of the South Stream, which are the two pipelines Russia built to skirt Ukraine and are meant to deliver gas to Europe, you know, they're threatened. So the question is, why is the European Union cooperating in this economic suicide? Because the long-term game is to get those transport routes. And the idea, again, is to pull the gas and oil from Ukraine and isolate Russia. You can come to control Russia's energy through controlling the transport system, but it's a very dangerous play. But then the United States, you know, they got away with it once before in the 1990s with the Russian bond market, which was the creation of the United States Treasury. You know, I don't know how many people are aware of it, but the whole 90s Russian operation was an off-the-books program initiated by Gerald Corrigan, who was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and vice chairman of the Federal Open Market Commission, and also George H.W. Bush, you know. But, you know, what basically had happened is that when the Soviet Union was wiped out and, you know, at this onset of the free trade politics of Mitterrand, George Bush, and Margaret Thatcher, you know, representatives of the financial oligarchy, the conditions of this utter chaos and criminal looting of Russia replaced any lie of scientific progress. And so the West is trying to do the same stuff again, you know, and they're trying to, you know, do this again, but they can't. They're having a really hard time because, for once, there are some sane Western leaders who are saying that this is insane, we're killing ourselves. Mm-hmm. And second, they're saying, you know, we're not going to go along with the United States because this is insane for us to do this because we are being wiped out. And, you know, we're seeing this actually very recently over the last few days, last week actually, when SWIFT, which is a clearing system controlled, you know, controlling basically the entire world money supply, said no to the United States when Americans wanted to kick Russia out of the system, you know, to try to hamper its ability to do business internationally. And that was a huge development that, you know, not too many media outlets picked it up.
Oh, well, I'm super proud of us then at Red Pill because we totally covered that. I was all over that because a lot of people, we bring a lot of economic people onto the show. First of all, I'm surprised with how many people have never heard of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is just as big as NATO. They, I mean, we're talking about a huge military anti-NATO coalition that exists, coincidentally only speaking Russian and Chinese. So that's a whole separate issue that we don't have time to get into today. But I've talked to a lot of economics experts, and they're all telling me, you know, the BRICS bank is never going to be anything. It's not significant. It's not going to, you know, it's a small bank. It's going to have no money. It's not going to ever compete. But then you look at the SWIFT situation, because really it isn't about the banking. It's about circumventing the sanctions. And if you can get a whole bunch of people who have been under the thumb of the Federal Reserve Organization or the Bretton Woods organizations for 20 years, 30 years, who are sick of it, and all they have to do is figure out a way to be able to transmit money without being under the thumb of these sanctions, they win. They won. So I think I'm really curious as to what you think is going to happen going forward into the future, because we seem to be in this kind of rocky no man's land. You know, I'm of the opinion that Russia kind of was supposed to go into World War III on that same day that Israel attacked Gaza and that MH17 was shot down. That was, in my opinion, supposed to be the we're in World War III. And Russia, Putin said, nah, no, we're not going to do that, and kind of flipped the script. So we're kind of in this like uncharted territory right now. What do you think about all that, Daniel?
I think what's, you know, the the big story, you know, aside from the SWIFT, yeah, if you covered it, so we're not going to go into that. But, you know, the interesting part is you know, this whole thing with Russia refusing to sell their oil and gas for anything but physical gold. I don't know if you've you know, seen this story. It's, you know, that's something that's been up a couple of months ago, and it's a huge story because this was actually the main reason why the Americans and the Cubans or the Americans, you know, reached out to Cuba. Because, you know, I see a lot of nonsense out there from people who don't really understand how things work geostrategically worldwide, who say that, oh, the Americans have given up and, you know, Cuba, the embargo and, you know, blockade is finally over and, you know, the truth has won and Americans have realized the error of their ways. Americans are cynics, you know, and not Americans, because Americans, unfortunately, don't understand what's going on around them. Mm-hmm. But the people who run America, obviously, they're not thinking, you know, the betterment of humanity. And so the idea of rapprochement with Cuba, maybe I'm wrong, you know, but, you know, the rapprochement with Cuba, the main objective of that, you know, is getting the little toehold in Cuba and using Cuba as a launching pad to destroy alliances that Russia has built over the years, you know, with Argentina and Ecuador and, you know, Venezuela and all these other countries, which, you know, are left-leaning, you know, corrupt. Obviously, a lot of them are, such as the case of Argentina. But the point is that you have a lot of, you know, nation states. Brazil is, you know, member of the BRICS, or very much in, you know, in the Russian camp. And if you can, you know, destroy them or destabilize them or bring in right-leaning governments, you certainly, you know, go a long way and try to dislodge Russia from its very, you know, obvious position of power right now. And yes, you know, if you kind of look at what they're doing, Americans, you know, they tried everything, you know, from aside from, you know, open invasion, they've done, you know, manipulated oil prices. That hasn't worked. You know, pushing the dollar down, ruble down, you know, it was like at one point it was like for about half an hour, it was like 100, you know, rubles to a dollar.
Yeah, it was way bad.
You know, and you know, everything from embargoes and blockades and trying to break up their alliances. Nothing has worked because, again, it's the only country in the world that can actually stand in the way of this one world company limited that these people are putting together. So, you know, again, the idea is that what the Russians are doing is they're saying, you know, to the West, we're going to sell you oil and gas as long as you pay physical gold. You don't have physical gold to pay with. Okay, give us dollars. We take the dollars and we immediately change it for, you know, gas and, for physical gold. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the last 6 months, Russia has bought almost 60% of all physical gold that has been sold in the world. In other words, more than all the central banks of the entire world. And it's amazing if you kind of, you know, think about it, because what is being done right now is that the Russians are controlling the game. And this game is that in exchange for Russian oil, gas, and also uranium, the West pays Russia with dollars, purchasing power of which is artificially inflated against oil and gold by the efforts, you know, manipulations of the West. And the game is going to be up, and everybody knows that it's going to be up when the Russians, you know, well, the Americans in the West runs out of gold, because they're going to say, we're not selling you our oil and gas anymore. And every think tank in the world has admitted that if you take the Russian oil and gas out of the equation, the world is going to go belly up. And the point is that what's going to happen, you know, when you extrapolate into not too distant future, where the very finite, you know, quantities of America's gold reserves, you know, run out, and the Russians say, you know, the game is up, we're not selling you any more of our reserves, you know, or the Western Europe for that matter. What's going to happen? Is America going to go to war? And if that's the case, there's going to be no tomorrow, because that's going to be pretty much the end of that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And, you know, the concern that I've got right now is that it doesn't look just like Russia is responding to this. It looks like the entire world, including maybe even the Bretton Woods organizations, because I keep hearing all this rhetoric about the expansion of the SDR basket or about potentially moving to asset-backed currencies globally. And then that would really leave us high and dry, because not only, as you accurately pointed out, are our resources fairly minuscule, any asset that we would have to back the currency, gold, you know, we don't even have gold now, but we've got oil until we decided to shoot ourselves in the foot and drop the price of oil down to where the shale industry is basically collapsing in our own country. But I wonder about, have you heard anything about that, the expansion of the SDR basket, or a change internationally in terms of global finance?
I mean, there's just so much talk right now of what might happen. You know, I think a lot of that stuff is, I think a lot of it is speculative. But, if you kind of look at what some of the, you know, experts are saying, I was just recently reading, David Stockman, who was the one-time director of the Office of Management and Budget under Reagan. You know, he made a very dire warning, you know, for the world citizens. He said that the global economy has entered the crack-up phase that may lead to the evaporation of much of the West's, you know, wealth. And, you know, if you know anything about this guy, he's someone you definitely should listen to. And, he's saying that the mismanagement of the global economy by the world's richer nations is about to reach its zenith, and we could cause the destruction of the economy. And the Western Europe is, you know, saying to the United States, you know, you're a big country, you're the world's most powerful country, but you're not more powerful than the world. Uh-huh. And we're sick and tired of fighting in wars. We don't want war with Russia. They're not doing anything to us. And, you know, under the pretext, which nobody believes anymore, yep, you know, we want the end to this kind of stuff. And you know, you see, so what you're seeing is that you're seeing, desperate moves by central banks, market volatility, you know, losses, deflation, you know, which will hit industrial commodity prices, you know, peak debt. We talked about peak oil, which is kind of stupid, but, you know, peak debt will definitely cause decreasing consumer demands on the world stage. You look at, you know, Germany, they were doing well, and, because China was buying a lot of their stuff, and now China is their economy is really cooling off, and so Germany is, you know, just, you know, literally went like one day, you know, doing well, the next day it's like, you know, slammed on the brakes, and week by week, it's like you have central bank after central bank is, look what Sweden has done. They lowered their money market ratios into negative territory.
Daniel, I got to cut you off, brother. I apologize, man. I set you up for failure on that. We obviously have to get together again and have another discussion.
Okay.
We're out of time, but thank you very much for taking time out and joining us today, sir.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, please go to redpillreports.com. If you go to the news and guest section under Daniel Eschelin's name, you'll be able to find a link to his Rocket Hub page so we can get this Bilderberg documentary help. Please give him some support, and also support him at danieleschelin.com. Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow Sharon Wyeth will be joining us, and the name of the game will be...
Truth Frequency Radio is your number one source for news and information. Without the hate, hype, and fear, we are proud to bring you cutting-edge programs like The Kev Baker Show,
The Christopher Everard Show,
The Freedom Link with Joe Joseph,
Truth Frequency with Chris and Shuri Geo,
Red Pill Reports
with J.D. Moore,
X-Squared with Brooks Agnew,
Down the Rabbit Hole with Popeye,
Freaky Friday
with The Woo Crew,
Waking Up the Masses
with Robert Bruce,
Phoenix Rising Radio,
and dozens more.
Did you know you can listen from any computer, mobile device, or from any telephone by dialing 832-225-5308.
Or call into your favorite show toll-free at 866-37-TRUTH.
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media.
24 hours a day.
Truth Frequency Radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.